Risk. We noted earlier that a risky action might present too low a probability of harm to any given person to cause him worry or fear, but he might fear a large number of such acts being performed. Each individual act's probability of causing harm falls below the threshold necessary for apprehension, but the combined totality of the acts may present a significant probability of harm. If different persons do each of the various acts in the totality, no one person is responsible for the resultant fear, nor can any one person easily be held to cause a distinguishable part of the fear. One action alone would not cause fear at all due to the threshold, and one action less would probably not diminish the fear. Our earlier considerations about fear provide a case for the prohibition of this totality of activities. But since parts of the totality could occur without ill consequence, it would be unnecessarily stringent to ban each and every component act. How is it to be decided which below-threshold subsets of such totalities are to be permitted? To tax each act would require a central or unified taxation and decision-making apparatus. The same could be said for social determination of which acts were valuable enough to permit, with other acts forbidden in order to shrink the totality to below the threshold. For example, it might be decided that mining or running trains is sufficiently valuable to be allowed, even though each presents risks to the passerby no less than compulsory Russian roulette with one bullet and N chambers, with N set appropriately, which is prohibited because it is insufficiently valuable. There are problems in a state of nature which has no central or unified apparatus capable of making or entitled to make these decisions. We discuss in Chapter 5 whether Herbert Hart's so-called principle of fairness aids here. The problems could lessen if the overall states, totality below the threshold and so on, can be reached by the operation of some invisible hand mechanism. But the precise mechanism to accomplish this has yet to be described, and it would also have to be shown how such a mechanism would arise in a state of nature. Here, as elsewhere, we would have use for a theory specifying what macro states are amenable to production by what sorts of invisible hand mechanisms. Actions that risk crossing another's boundary pose serious problems for a natural rights position. The diversity of cases further complicates the issues. It may be known which persons will undergo a risk, or merely that it will happen to someone or other. The probability of the harm may be known exactly or within a specified range, and so on. Imposing how slight a probability of a harm that violates someone's rights also violates his rights? Instead of one cutoff probability for all harms, perhaps the cutoff probability is lower the more severe the harm. Here one might have the picture of a specified value, the same for all acts, to mark the boundary of rights violation. An action violates someone's rights if its expected harm to him, that is, its probability of harm to him, multiplied by a measure of that harm, is greater than or equal to the specified value. But what is the magnitude of the specified value? The harm of the least significant act, yielding only that harm for certain, that violates a person's natural rights? This construal of the problem cannot be utilized by a tradition which holds that stealing a penny or a pin or anything from someone violates his rights. That tradition does not select a threshold measure of harm as a lower limit, in the case of harms certain to occur. It is difficult to imagine a principled way in which the natural rights tradition can draw the line to fix which probabilities impose unacceptably great risks upon others. This means that it is difficult to see how, in these cases, the natural rights tradition draws the boundaries it focuses upon. One might plausibly argue that beginning with probabilities that may vary continuously and asking that some line be drawn misconstrues the problem and almost guarantees that any position of the line, other than 0 or 1, will appear arbitrary. An alternative procedure would begin with considerations perpendicular to those about probabilities, theoretically developing them into an answer to the questions about risky actions. Two types of theories could be developed. A theory could specify where a line is to be drawn without this position's seeming arbitrary, because though the line comes at a place which is not special along the probability dimension, it is distinguished along the different dimensions considered by the theory. Or a theory could provide criteria for deciding about the risky actions that do not involve drawing a line along the probability or expected value or some similar dimension, whereby all the actions falling on one side of the line are treated in one way and all those on the other side in another. The considerations of the theory do not place the actions in the same order affected by the probability dimension, nor does the theory partition actions into equivalence classes coextensive with some interval partition of the unit line. The considerations the theory adduces merely treat the question differently, and so have the consequence that some act is forbidden, while another with a higher expected value of harm is permitted. Unfortunately, no satisfactory specific alternative theory of either type has yet been produced. If no natural law theory has yet specified a precise line delimiting people's natural rights in risky situations, what is to happen in the state of nature? With regard to any particular action that imposes a risk of a boundary crossing upon others, we have the following three possibilities. 1. The action is prohibited and punishable, even if compensation is paid for any boundary crossing, or if it turns out to have crossed no boundary. 2. The action is permitted provided compensation is paid to those persons whose boundaries actually are crossed. 3. The action is permitted provided compensation is paid to all those persons who undergo a risk of a boundary crossing, whether or not it turns out that their boundary actually is crossed. Under the third alternative, people can choose the second. They can pool their payments for undergoing risk so as to compensate fully those whose boundaries actually are crossed. The third alternative will be plausible if imposing the risk on another plausibly is viewed as itself crossing a boundary to be compensated for, perhaps because it is apprehended and hence imposes fear on the other. Persons voluntarily incurring such risks in the market are compensated by receiving higher wages for working at risky jobs, whether or not the risk eventuates. Instead of compensating them, can the agent supply tranquilizers to all those upon whom the risk is imposed so that they won't feel very afraid? Should they have to tranquilize themselves so that it's not the agent's concern at all if they neglect to do so and feel fear? For an illuminating initial tangling of such issues, see Ronald Coase, The Problem of Social Costs, Journal of Law and Economics, 1960, pages 1 to 44. Charles Fried has recently suggested that people would be willing to agree to a system that allows them to impose normal risks of death upon each other, preferring this to a system that forbids all such imposing of risk. No one is especially disadvantaged. Each gains the right to perform risky activities upon others in the pursuit of his own ends, in exchange for granting the others the right to do the same to him. These risks others impose upon him are risks he himself would be willing to undergo in the pursuit of his own ends. The same is true of the risks he imposes on others. However, the world is so constructed that in pursuing their ends, people often must impose risks upon others that they cannot take directly upon themselves. A trade naturally suggests itself. Putting Fried's argument in terms of an exchange suggests another alternative, namely, explicit compensation for each risk of a boundary crossing imposed upon another, the third possibility listed earlier. Such a scheme would differ from Fried's risk pool in the direction of greater fairness. However, the process of actually carrying out the payments and ascertaining the precise risk imposed upon others and the appropriate compensation would seem to involve enormous transaction costs. Some efficiencies easily can be imagined. For example, keep central records for all, with net payments made every N months. But in the absence of some neat institutional device, it remains enormously cumbersome. Because great transaction costs may make the fairest alternative impracticable, one may search for other alternatives, such as Fried's risk pool. These alternatives will involve constant minor unfairness and classes of major ones. For example, children who die from the eventuating of the risks of death imposed upon them receive no actual benefit comparable to that of the risk imposers. This situation is not significantly alleviated by the fact that every adult faced these risks as a child, and that every child who reaches adulthood will be able to impose these risks on yet other children. A system that compensates only those upon whom risks eventuate, the second possibility listed earlier, would be far more manageable and would involve far smaller costs of operation and transaction than one which pays all those upon whom the risk is imposed. The third possibility listed earlier. Risks of death present the hardest issues. How can the magnitude of the harm be estimated? If the harm of death cannot actually be compensated for, the next best alternative, even apart from any issue of fear, might be to compensate all those upon whom its risk is imposed. But though post-mortem payment to relatives or favorite charities, upkeep of elaborate cemetery arrangements, and so forth, all have obvious flaws insofar as the deceased is concerned, an individual himself can benefit from a system of post-mortem compensatory payment to the estates of victims. While alive, he can sell the right to this payment, should it have to be made, to a company that purchases many such rights. The price would be no greater than the right's expected monetary value, the probability of such payment multiplied by the amount. How much lower the price would be would depend upon the degree of competition in the industry, the interest rate, and so on. Such a system would not compensate fully any actual victim for the measured harm, and others not actually harmed also would benefit from having sold their collection rights. But each might view it, ex ante, as a reasonably satisfactory arrangement. Earlier, we described a way of pooling payments and transforming the third possibility into the second. Here, we have a way of transforming the second into the third. This system also might give an individual a financial incentive to raise his life's monetary value, as measured by the compensation criteria, to increase the price for which he could sell the right to compensation. The principle of compensation. Even when permitting an action provided compensation is paid, the second or third possibilities listed earlier, is prima facie more appropriate for a risky action than prohibiting it, the first possibility listed earlier. The issue of its being prohibited or permitted to someone still is not completely settled, for some persons will lack sufficient funds to pay the required compensation should the need arise, and they will not have purchased insurance to cover their obligations in that eventuality. May these persons be forbidden to perform the action? Forbidding an action to those not in a position to pay compensation differs from forbidding it, unless compensation is paid to those actually harmed, the second possibility listed, in that in the former case, but not in the latter, someone who lacks provision for paying compensation may be punished for his action, even though it does not actually harm anyone or cross a boundary. Does someone violate another's rights by performing an action without sufficient means or liability insurance to cover its risks? May he be forbidden to do this or punished for doing it? Since an enormous number of actions do increase risk to others, a society which prohibited such uncovered actions would ill fit a picture of a free society as one embodying a presumption in favor of liberty, under which people permissibly could perform actions so long as they didn't harm others in specified ways. Yet how can people be allowed to impose risks on others whom they are not in a position to compensate should the need arise? Why should some have to bear the costs of others' freedom? Yet to prohibit risky acts, because they are financially uncovered or because they are too risky, limits individuals' freedom to act, even though the actions actually might involve no cost at all to anyone else. Any given epileptic, for example, might drive throughout his lifetime without thereby harming anyone. Forbidding him to drive may not actually lessen the harm to others, and for all anyone knows, it doesn't. It is true that we cannot identify in advance the individual who will turn out harmless, but why should he bear the full burden of our inability? Prohibiting someone from driving in our automobile-dependent society in order to reduce the risk to others seriously disadvantages that person, It costs money to remedy these disadvantages, hiring a chauffeur or using taxis. Consider the claim that a person must be compensated for the disadvantages imposed upon him by being forbidden to perform an activity for these sorts of reasons. Those who benefit from the reduction in risks to themselves have to make up to those who are restricted. So stated, the net has been cast too broadly. Must I really compensate someone when, in self-defense, I stop him from playing Russian roulette on me? If some person wishes to use a very risky but efficient, and if things go well, harmless process in manufacturing a product, must the residents near the factory compensate him for the economic loss he suffers from not being allowed to use the possibly dangerous process? Surely not. Perhaps a few words should be said about pollution, the dumping of negative effects upon other people's property, such as their houses, clothing, and lungs, and upon unowned things which people benefit from, such as a clean and beautiful sky. I shall discuss only effects on property. It would be undesirable, and is not excluded by anything I say here, for someone to channel all of his pollution effects high above anyone's property volume, making the sky a murky gray-green. Nothing is gained by trying to transform the second type of case into the first by saying, for example, that someone who changes the way the sky looks dumps effects on one's eyes. What follows in this note is incomplete in that it does not treat the second type of case. Since it would exclude too much to forbid all polluting activities, how might a society, socialist or capitalist, decide which polluting activities to forbid and which to permit? Presumably, it should permit those polluting activities whose benefits are greater than their costs, including within their costs their polluting effects. The most feasible theoretical test of this net benefit is whether the activity could pay its way, whether those who benefit from it would be willing to pay enough to cover the costs of compensating those ill affected by it. Those who favor any worthy activity that fails this test can make charitable donations to it. For example, certain modes of airplane service impose noise pollution on homes surrounding airports. In one way or another, through lower resale value, lower rent obtainable for apartments, and so on, the economic value of these homes is diminished. Only if the benefits to air passengers are greater than these costs to airport neighbors should the noisier mode of transportation service go on. A society must have some way to determine whether the benefits do outweigh the costs. Secondly, it must decide how the costs are to be allocated. It can let them fall where they happen to fall, in our example, on the local homeowners. Or it can try to spread the cost throughout the society. Or it can place it on those who benefit from the activity, in our example, airports, airlines, and ultimately the air passenger. The last, if feasible, seems fairest. If a polluting activity is to be allowed to continue on the ground that its benefits outweigh its costs, including its polluting costs, then those who benefit actually should compensate those upon whom the pollution costs are initially thrown. The compensation might encompass paying for the costs of devices to lessen the initial pollution effects. In our example, airlines or airports might pay for soundproofing a house, and then pay compensation for how much less the economic value of that house is than the value of the original unsoundproofed house in the neighborhood, as it was without the additional noise. When each of the victims of pollution suffers great costs, the usual system of tort liability, with minor modifications, suffices to yield this result. Enforcing other people's property rights will, in these cases, suffice to keep pollution in its proper place. But the situation is changed if individual polluters have widespread and individually minuscule effects. If someone imposes the equivalent of a 20-cent cost on each person in the United States, it will not pay for any one person to sue him, despite the great total of the cost imposed. If many persons similarly impose tiny costs on each individual, the total costs to an individual then may be significant. But since no single source significantly affects one individual, it still will not pay any individual to sue any individual polluter. It is ironic that pollution is commonly held to indicate defects in the privateness of a system of private property, whereas the problem of pollution is that high transaction costs make it difficult to enforce the private property rights of the victims of pollution. One solution might be to allow group suits against polluters. Any lawyer or law firm may act for the general public and sue, being required to distribute a proportion of the amount collected to each member of the included public who claims it from them. Since different people are differently affected by the same polluting acts, the lawyers might be required to distribute different amounts to those in different specified groups. The lawyer's income would come from those who do not write in to claim their due, and from earnings of the money of those who do not claim promptly. Seeing some receiving great income in this way, others would go into business as public's agents, charging a yearly fee to collect and turn over to their clients all the pollution payments to which they were entitled. Since such a scheme gives great advantage to a lawyer who acts fast, it ensures that many would be alert to protect the interests of those polluted. Alternative schemes might be devised to allow several to sue simultaneously for distinct sets of persons in the public. It is true that these schemes place great weight on the court system, but they should be as manageable as the operation of any government bureaucracy in determining and distributing costs. The proposal I make here can, I think, be defended against the considerations adduced in Frank Michelman's sophisticated presentation of a contrasting view in his Pollution as a Tort, an essay review of Guido Calabresi's The Costs of Accidents, in Yale Law Journal 80, 1917, Part 5, pages 666 to 683. I do not mean to put forth this scheme as the solution to controlling pollution. Rather, I wish merely to suggest and make plausible the view that some institutional arrangement might be devised to solve the problem at a fell swoop, and to command the task to those clever at such things. J. H. Dales proposes in Pollution, Property, and Prices to sell transferable rights to pollute in specified amounts. This elegant proposal, unfortunately, involves central decision as to the desirable total amount of pollution. Popular discussions often run pollution problems together with that of conserving natural resources. Again, the clearest examples of misdirected activity have occurred where there are no clear private property rights, on public lands denuded by timber companies, and in oil fields under separately held pieces of land. To the extent that future people, or we later, will be willing to pay for the satisfaction of their desires, including trips through unspoiled forests and wilderness land, it will be in the economic interests of some to conserve the necessary resources. See the discussion in Rothbard, Power and Market, Menlo Park, California, Institute for Humane Studies, 1970, pages 47 to 52, and in the references he cites. To arrive at an acceptable principle of compensation, we must delimit the class of actions covered by the claim. Some types of action are generally done, play an important role in people's lives, and are not forbidden to a person without seriously disadvantaging him. One principle might run: when an action of this type is forbidden to someone because it might cause harm to others, and is especially dangerous when he does it, then those who forbid in order to gain increased security for themselves must compensate the person forbidden for the disadvantage they place him under. This principle is meant to cover forbidding the epileptic to drive while excluding the cases of involuntary Russian roulette and the special manufacturing process. The idea is to focus on important activities done by almost all, though some do them more dangerously than others. Almost everyone drives a car, whereas playing Russian roulette or using an especially dangerous manufacturing process is not a normal part of almost everyone's life. Unfortunately, this approach to the principle places a very great burden on the scheme used to classify actions. The fact that there is one description of a person's action that distinguishes it from the acts of others does not classify it as unusual, and so outside the sphere of application of the principle. Yet it would be too strong to say, on the other hand, that any action falling under some description which almost every other person also instantiates is thereby shown to be usual and to fall within the compass of the principle. For unusual activities also fall under some descriptions that cover actions people normally do. Playing Russian roulette is a more dangerous way of having fun, which others are allowed to do, and using the special manufacturing process is a more dangerous way of earning a living. Almost any two actions can be construed as the same or different, depending upon whether they fall into the same or different subclasses in the background classification of actions. This possibility of diverse descriptions of actions prevents easy application of the principle as stated. If these questions could be clarified satisfactorily, we might wish to extend the principle to cover some unusual actions. If using the dangerous process is the only way that person can earn a living, and if playing Russian roulette on another with a gun of 100,000 chambers is the only way that person can have any enjoyment at all, I grant these are both extravagant suppositions, then perhaps this person should be compensated for the prohibition. By having the only way he can earn a living forbidden to him, he is disadvantaged as compared to the normal situation, whereas someone is not disadvantaged relative to the normal situation by having his most profitable alternative forbidden to him. A disadvantage as compared to the normal situation differs from being made worse off than one otherwise would be. One might use a theory of disadvantage, if one had it, in order to formulate a principle of compensation. Those who are disadvantaged by being forbidden to do actions that only might harm others must be compensated for these disadvantages foisted upon them in order to provide security for the others. If people's increased security from a contemplated prohibition would benefit them less than those prohibited would be disadvantaged, then potential prohibitors will be unable or unwilling to make sufficiently great compensatory payments, so the prohibition, as is proper in this case, will not be imposed. The principle of compensation covers the cases falling under our earlier statement, which involved messy problems about classifying actions. It does not avoid completely similar questions concerning the circumstances under which someone is especially disadvantaged. But as they arise here, the questions are easier to handle. For example, is the manufacturer who is prevented from pursuing his best alternative, though having other profitable alternatives, especially disadvantaged if everyone else may pursue their best alternatives, which happen not to be dangerous? Clearly not. The principle of compensation requires that people be compensated for having certain risky activities prohibited to them. It might be objected that either you have the right to forbid these people's risky activities or you don't. If you do, you needn't compensate the people for doing to them what you have a right to do. And if you don't, then rather than formulating a policy of compensating people for your unrightful forbidding, you ought simply to stop it. In neither case does the appropriate course seem to be to forbid and then compensate. But the dilemma, either you have a right to forbid it so you needn't compensate, or you don't have a right to forbid it so you should stop, is too short. It may be that you do have a right to forbid an action, but only provided you compensate those to whom it is forbidden. How can this be? Is this situation one of those discussed earlier in which a border crossing is permitted provided that compensation is paid? If so, there would be some boundary line that delimits forbidding people to do certain risky acts, which it would be permissible to cross if the party trespassed upon were compensated. Even if so, since in the cases under discussion we can identify in advance the particular persons being forbidden, why are we not required instead to negotiate a contract with them whereby they agree not to do the risky act in question? Why wouldn't we have to offer them an incentive or hire them or bribe them to refrain from doing the act? In our earlier discussion of border crossing, we noted the absence of any compelling theory of just price or compelling reason why all of the benefits of voluntary exchange should go to one of the parties. Which of the admissible points on the contract curve was to be selected, we said, was a question appropriately left to the parties involved. This consideration favored prior negotiation over posterior payment of full compensation. In the present subclass of cases, however, it does seem appropriate uniformly to select one extremity of the contract curve. Unlike exchanges in which both parties benefit, and it is unclear how these benefits are to be divided, in negotiations over one party's abstaining from an action that will or might endanger another person, all the first party need receive is full compensation. The payment the first party could negotiate for abstaining, were he allowed to perform the action, is not part of his loss due to the prohibition for which he must be compensated. Productive exchange. If I buy a good or service from you, I benefit from your activity. I am better off due to it, better off than if your activity wasn't done or you didn't exist at all. Ignore the complication that someone once might sell a bona fide good to another person he generally harms. Whereas if I pay you for not harming me, I gain nothing from you that I wouldn't possess if either you didn't exist at all or existed without having anything to do with me. This comparison wouldn't do if I deserved to be harmed by you. Roughly, productive activities are those that make purchasers better off than if the seller had nothing at all to do with them. More precisely, this provides a necessary condition for an unproductive activity, but not a sufficient condition. If your next-door neighbor plans to erect a certain structure on his land, which he has a right to do, you might be better off if he didn't exist at all. No one else would choose to erect that monstrosity. Yet purchasing his abstention from proceeding with his plans will be a productive exchange. Suppose, however, that the neighbor has no desire to erect the structure on the land. He formulates his plan and informs you of it solely in order to sell you his abstention from it. Such an exchange would not be a productive one. It merely gives you relief from something that would not threaten, if not for the possibility of an exchange, to get relief from it. The point generalizes to the case where the neighbor's desire does not focus only upon you. He may formulate the plan and peddle his abstention around to several neighbors. Whoever purchases it will be served unproductively. That such exchanges are not productive ones and do not benefit each party is shown by the fact that if they were impossible or forcibly prohibited so that everyone knew they couldn't be done, one of the parties to the potential exchange would be no worse off. A strange kind of productive exchange it would be whose forbidding leaves one party no worse off. The party who does not give up anything for the abstention, or need not because the neighbor has no other motive to proceed with the action, is left better off. Though people value a blackmailer's silence and pay for it, his being silent is not a productive activity. His victims would be as well off if the blackmailer did not exist at all, and so wasn't threatening them, and they would be no worse off if the exchange were known to be absolutely impossible. But if he didn't exist, mightn't another have stumbled on the unique piece of information and asked a higher price for silence? If this would have occurred, isn't the victim better off because his actual blackmailer exists? To state the point exactly in order to exclude such complications is not worth the effort it would require. On the view we take here, a seller of such silence could legitimately charge only for what he foregoes by silence. What he foregoes does not include the payment he could have received to abstain from revealing his information, though it does include the payments others would make to him to reveal the information. So someone writing a book whose research comes across information about another person which would help sales if included in the book may charge another who desires that this information be kept secret, including the person who is the subject of the information, for refraining from including the information in the book. He may charge an amount of money equal to his expected difference in royalties between the book containing this information and the book without it. He may not charge the best price he could get from the purchaser of his silence. A writer or other person who delights in revealing secrets may charge differently. This consideration does not help the racketeer to be discussed shortly, even if he is sadistic and enjoys his work. The activity he threatens is excluded by moral constraints and is prohibited independently of whether it, or abstaining from it, is charged for. The example of the writer is taken from footnote 34 of my essay Coercion in Philosophy, Science, and Method, Essays in Honor of Ernest Nagel, editor S. Morgan Besser, P. Supps and M. White, New York, St. Martin's Press, 1969, pages 440 to 472. Contrast our view of blackmail with the following, which sees it as on a par with any other economic transaction. Blackmail would not be illegal in the free society, for blackmail is the receipt of money in exchange for the service of not publicizing certain information about the other person. No violence or threat of violence to person or property is involved. Murray N. Rothbard, Man, Economy and State, Volume 1, page 443 and 49. Protective services are productive and benefit their recipient, whereas the protection racket is not productive. Being sold the racketeer's mere abstention from harming you makes your situation no better than if they had nothing to do with you at all. Our earlier discussion of dividing the benefits of voluntary exchange, thus, should be narrowed so as to apply only to those exchanges where both parties do benefit in the sense of being the recipients of productive activities. Where one of the parties does not so benefit and is unproductively served, it is fair that he merely barely compensates the other, if any compensation is due the other party at all. What of those cases where only the first condition of unproductive exchange is satisfied, not the second? X is no better off as a result of the exchange than if Y didn't exist at all, but Y does have some motive other than selling abstention. If from Y's abstention from an activity, X gains only a lessened probability of having his own border crossed, a crossing whose intentional performance is prohibited, then Y need be compensated only for the disadvantages imposed upon him by the prohibition of only those activities whose risk is serious enough to justify prohibition in this manner. We have rejected the view that the prohibition of risky activities is illegitimate, that through prior agreements and open negotiations, people must be induced to agree voluntarily to refrain from the activities. But we should not construe our case merely as compensation for crossing a border that protects another's risky action, with the requirement of prior negotiation obviated by the special nature of the case. It doesn't involve any productive exchange. For this does not explain why all are not returned to the indifference curve they would occupy were it not for the prohibition. Only those disadvantaged by a prohibition are to be compensated, and they are to be compensated only for their disadvantages. If a prohibition of risky acts had two separate effects on someone, the first making him worse off, though not disadvantaged as compared to others, and the second disadvantaging him, the principle of compensation would require compensation to be paid only for the second. Unlike an ordinary border crossing, the compensation in these cases need not raise the person to the position he was in before he was interfered with. In order to view the compensation under the principle of compensation as ordinary compensation for a border crossing, one might try to redefine or relocate the border so that it is crossed only when someone is disadvantaged. But it is more perspicuous not to distort our view of this compensation situation by assimilating it to another one. That it is not to be assimilated to the border-crossing sort of compensation situation does not, of course, foreclose deriving the principle of compensation from deeper principles. For our purposes in this essay, we need not do this, nor need we state the principle exactly. We need only claim the correctness of some principles, such as the principle of compensation, requiring those imposing a prohibition on risky activities to compensate those disadvantaged through having these risky activities prohibited to them. I am not completely comfortable presenting and later using a principle whose details have not been worked out fully, even though the undeveloped aspects of the principle do not appear to be relevant to the issues upon which we shall wield it. With some justice, I think, I could claim that it is all right as a beginning to leave a principle in a somewhat fuzzy state. The primary question is whether something like it will do. This claim, however, would meet a frosty reception from those many proponents of another principle scrutinized in the next chapter, if they knew how much harder I shall be on their principle than I am here on mine. Fortunately, they don't know that yet.